Good morning. Good morning, everybody. Give me a thumbs up or a fist pump if you all can hear me this morning. Excellent. Today is episode 46 of the Bitcoin Veteran Spaces, and I am your host, Coleman. And I want to welcome everybody who's joining us. I see Wade out in the audience. I haven't seen you in a while, sir. It's good to see you. Hunter, Punchplate, AC, Texas Toast, Eomar. Good morning, Greg Foss. How are you doing?
Hey, Coleman. Good morning.
While everyone's still funneling into the room, into the spaces, refilling your coffee, getting your tea, getting your water, or just getting the gunk out of your eyes, really quickly, just want to go over the purpose, the reason we do this every weekday, Monday through Friday at 10 a.m., and that's to make sure everyone understands the values that our founding fathers fought for are not to be taken for granted. We need to make sure everyone understands that our right to liberty, our right to free speech, our right to due process, freedom of religion is all something that we should not be taking for granted. And we need to show the world that we will fight for these rights. And there's no better way to show that than showing the world what a decentralized technology, decentralized currency can do. And that's Bitcoin. If y'all haven't heard, we have Operation Gabriel going on right now in North Carolina, and we are showing everybody that's been affected, everybody that's been helping out, whether it's other organizations or government agencies, what we as Bitcoiners can do to make our impact. And because of your help and your generosity, we've raised over $115,000 for that cause. And those funds are going to help the people directly that have been impacted. So we're using it to provide warm weather clothing for everyone, generators, fuel for those generators. We're also trying to acquire feed for livestock. During that storm, it wiped out everybody's crops and their stores. And so we need to make sure that we're able to feed the livestock that these farmers and the community still have. So if you haven't done it, we have a link up in the nest. If you could just go ahead and retweet those posts for Operation Gabriel, make sure that we're getting the message still spread. Unfortunately, for everyone that's been involved or affected, this isn't a quick fix for them. It's going to take about 3 to 6 months before they start getting things back to normal. So we want to make sure that everybody is not being forgotten, and we're going to do our part to make sure that they're taken care of. I see we have BitPetro, Texas Toast, and Eomar up on the panel. Good morning, everybody. How you doing?
Morning. Doing pretty well. How are you?
Buenos dias.
Fantastic. So I want to jump into this. This kind of this news, or what we're going to be talking about, broke while I was getting all my notes together today for today's spaces. But Paul Tudor Jones went on CNBC this morning and made some very interesting comments about the state of the economy. And I think the biggest takeaway that we all are aware of is all roads lead to inflation. And he said, quote, "I'm long gold and I am long Bitcoin." And so Foss, I know you made a post earlier about this, so I'd like to just throw this ball right to you and get your take on what Mr. Jones had said.
Okay, well, thanks, Coleman. Everybody, good to see you. The gist of it is that it's an inflation spiral that is driven by the debt burden of the United States. And let's just go over some numbers quickly. These are numbers that certainly Larry Lepard and I and James Lavish and other Preston Pish, other people who have pointed to the unsustainability of the U.S. Debt situation have talked about a lot, but let's just go over them. So $35 trillion in, close to $36 trillion in debt, funded debt outstanding in the United States, which is growing because of a deficit, a government deficit. So the deficit running on an annual basis of, let's say, close to $2 trillion. So you bring in $5 trillion of tax revenues, but you spend $7 trillion. That is a $2 trillion deficit that needs to be funded. So you're growing the outstanding debt burden by $2 trillion. But here's the number that no one brings up. And Paul Tudor Jones says, and this is growing into the future as far as the eye can see. But he didn't bring up the unfunded obligations, the entitlements that Americans are expecting, that Medicare and Social Security entitlements that total today $210 trillion. So there's an argument that can be made by me that the actual obligations of the USA is closer to $250 trillion. Now, you can't look at these numbers in isolation. You have to look at them compared to the size of the economy as measured by gross domestic product. But even then, it's pretty scary. And Paul Tudor Jones mentioned the current debt burden as a percent of GDP. And he is projecting, and it's currently at 130%, which means that the $35 trillion of outstanding debt is 130% as large as the economy, which is over $25 trillion. But there's the math, and projected to grow, in Tudor Jones's estimate, to 200% of GDP over the next, I think he said 30 years, but I'm not positive in the interview.
He said by 2034, so 10 years.
It's going to go to 200%?
Yes, okay, that's what he was quoted.
That's higher than for certain the usdebtclock.org projects by 2034. They think it goes to only $60 trillion. By 2032, they think 8 years out goes to $60 trillion or 170% of GDP. Nonetheless, these are astronomical numbers that are driving Tudor Jones to make his investment thesis on inflation trade. And yes, he is short, long treasury bonds, so the long end of the yield curve. He's long Bitcoin and long gold. And the reason is he is concerned that the interest expense on the debt is going to increase because interest rates are going to go higher as foreign investors hesitate to fund the USA spending reckless, and it's not necessarily reckless, but it looks reckless, their spending habits. So over to you if you have any questions.
I definitely have some follow-up questions. My biggest one, and I don't know the answers, why is no one else focusing on the unfunded liabilities? When did they come due, and when does this become something where they really just can't ignore anymore? Like that's just the number is so large, it's silly.
Well, yes, and a politician won't focus on them because if they are going to cut those entitlements, they're not going to win election. And then a lot of people just don't realize the commitments that the implied commitments that are made to the population, that the population may be counting on, that mathematically very difficult to fulfill. So people aren't focusing on it, I think, Coleman. Firstly, none of the politicians are even, with the exception of Elon Musk, he's not a true politician, but none of the parties are focusing on the debt situation because it's a very difficult situation to solve. And Tudor Jones laid out some methodologies of solving it, but all of them, his solution includes raising taxes, cutting entitlements, cutting government workers. He did mention, you know, the rising interest rates that you can't control, but if the Fed and the Treasury invoke some sort of yield curve control where bonds, the yield on bonds is held below the rate of inflation, which are negative real yields, right? That's people need to understand that you're earning a return on your bonds that is less than inflation. Typically, bonds have a premium so that there's a real yield that's greater than inflation. But if you hold interest rates so that the yield or the interest rates are less than inflation, and then the growth of the economy is measured including inflation, then you can get a scenario, which I don't believe happens, but mathematically it's possible, where you can get your you can inflate your way out of the debt crisis. So you don't focus on entitlements because we're dealing with a $35 trillion problem that's already out of control. Imagine adding the other $210 trillion to that equation, Coleman. It's just mind-boggling.
So then what happens when we start lowering interest rates? Because I think we can all agree that we have to get these down lower because the interest on the debt is astronomical. It's over $1 trillion per year. So what happens if we try and get these down closer to zero so we're not paying as much interest? Does that not cause an issue for foreign buyers of our debt?
Because great question. But don't forget, largely, so that firstly, when you're talking get these down below, get these down lower, the Fed only controls the short end of the yield curve with interest rate policy. That's the overnight rate or the short end that will impact, you know, 2-year bonds out to 5-year bonds. But the long end of the curve is large with the absence of yield curve control and any interference by politicians or government agencies, that is set by open market rates, open market buyers and sellers. And that's currently, those are the rates that have gone on the day that the Fed cut 50 basis points. So they cut the short end, the overnight rate from 5.25 to 4.75 by 50 basis points. The short end came down, but the 10-year note went from 3.6%, and is now currently at 4.2%. So that rate, which is set by buyers and sellers, including short sellers of the bonds, pushed the price down and the yields up in the long end of the curve. And that's, you know that Druckenmiller is shorting long treasuries, and so is Paul Tudor Jones. There's an interesting person on Twitter. I don't know who it is, but the handle is Magoo, Hoddle Magoo. And the great thing is we don't always see eye to eye, but I do find a lot of good info in his posts, and we frequently have some good back and forth. He basically said something quite interesting that, you know, Druckenmiller and Tudor Jones are both on national TV advocating short positions in long treasury bonds. This is interesting because it just makes the government's job to fund themselves more difficult, right? As the interest rate goes higher, interest expense, as you mentioned, increases, and it's already greater at $1 trillion in annual interest expense. It's already greater than defense spending in the US budget. It's a bigger line item than defense spending. So it's already out of control on a relative basis. Remember, the USA only brings in $5 trillion a year. And 1/5 of that, 20% of that, goes towards paying the interest. Well, they'll fund themselves in the short end of the curve if they have to, or invoke some money printing to get yield curve control in the long end. But what does all that mean? That means further debasement and more reason to own Bitcoin and other hard assets.
Yes, and that's what he had said in that interview. He did say that he's extremely long gold and extremely long Bitcoin because all the roads are just leading to higher inflation. So you need hard assets. So I do think it's interesting that you're getting these big names coming out publicly and talking about it. And you can even include Elon Musk. He's coming out, like you'd mentioned, and he's addressing these issues.
Yeah, Elon's not shorting long treasury bonds, though. I think it's... you know, it's quite interesting. It's I wonder if there'll be a control. You know, there was a time in the great financial crisis in 2008, 2009, where you were not allowed to short sell the shares of financial institutions, of the big banks that were under stress. The government restricted you from short selling the equities of the financial institutions. I say that because I know, but I also know investors that were penalized by that, including our friend Larry Lepard. I had some short positions in the financial institutions equities that were he had to cover and cost his investors, not that he lost money on the trade, but the opportunity cost. So will there be a time when it's forbidden to short sell U.S. Treasury bonds? I don't know. I'm not predicting it, but it's not a 0% chance. Much like, you know, we always have to manage outcomes on a probability basis. I think we said that on your show yesterday. So keep an open mind what Tudor Jones was saying, but also how big that message is from two of the largest and most successful hedge fund managers in the USA, both taking negative views on the credit position of the USA, the borrowing and funding. But also, why are they doing it? Because I've said before, if the USA couldn't print money, the debt metrics and interest coverage ratios and things of the USA, if it was a corporation, reflect a zombie-like company where you can barely produce, or you don't even have enough cash flow to cover your interest expense on new debt that you're issuing. So you're issuing debt to pay old debt, but you can't even fund the interest expense on the old debt. So the new debt is actually being used to pay interest expense as well. It's a circular loop, the debt spiral that we frequently talk about.
I'm not going to hold you to this prediction, but when do you think this becomes a point where no one, like, you can't deny it anymore? Like, it's inevitable.
It already is inevitable, in my opinion. But when does the world wake up to this? Obviously, a lot of people hope that they don't, including the Minneapolis Fed, right? That yesterday said they want to run permanent primary deficits, which is just another way of saying they want to be able to fund their obligations with issuing more debt. So Tudor Jones laid out a scenario where he asked Andrew Ross Sorkin, I want to borrow, and he put this pretty neatly, and he put it in percentages, but, you know, he wanted to borrow $100,000 from Sorkin and pay him over 30 years and promise he would pay him back over 30 years. But then he also wanted to borrow another $700,000 from Sorkin, or the equivalent of increasing your borrowing by $40,000 each year, and you'd also pay that back in 30 years. And then he asked Sorkin, would you lend me that money? And Sorkin said, well, there's no way I would lend you the money. And Tudor Jones said, well, that's the situation that the U.S. that's the situation of the U.S. long bond right now, the 30-year bond. So, you know, it's with analogies like that you know, you talk to hosts, and I wonder if Sorkin even truly understood the question that, that Tudor Jones was asking in the context that he was relating it to the U.S. Deficit situation or debt situation. So when does it happen? You know, there's lots of expressions, slowly, then suddenly. Lynn Alden, there's no stopping this train. The Minneapolis Fed acknowledging it, but then also saying, well, we got to get rid of Bitcoin because Bitcoin people know. And we don't want the rest of the world to know about this. So, you know, I spent my career as a credit in the credit markets. And there's an expression, risk happens fast. Like risk happens fast. It you think everything's fine and, oh, it's going to continue along. But all of a sudden, it's like that bug hitting your windshield. You know, bang, everything's fine until it hits the windshield. So I don't know. And, you know, I don't want it to happen where, which is to say, I don't want the USA not to be able to fund itself. That would be catastrophic because it would basically mean that every single government in the world would be in the same situation because the USA still is the best looking horse at the glue factory, right? It's the, everyone's in the same situation, but the USA is still the best, but they're all horses at the glue factory.
Oh, that's interesting. And again, when I talk about this, I'm not championing for the United States to default or the dollar to collapse because it would cause extreme pain across every sector. Everybody would feel that. But I'm just always curious as we're hearing this. And I don't know if it's just the echo chamber of Twitter, but to me, it just seems like everyone's been screaming this, and you can see the writing on the wall. And so, again, I think I mentioned it yesterday, the timing of those reports. It just seems a little coincidental.
Did you? Okay. Well, I don't know. They certainly are bringing. They're certainly bringing more attention to it indirectly, and it's only mathematics. So, it's, you know, what will we do to try and, you know, with in my case, this is what brought me to Bitcoin. Is the USA debt spiral and the fiat debasing, which is, in my opinion, 100% certain. So everybody gets to the conclusion in different ways, I guess. And then some people will never understand it. Coleman, it's you know, balancing a federal budget and not just balancing it, understanding it is important. And then you'll get champions like, you know, smart people like Joe Colasari, who doesn't quite think that the debt spiral is the problem and does believe that, you know, you can get growth rates of the economy, nominal growth rates in the economy greater than nominal interest rates, inflation included. It's possible. It's not certain. And then nobody mentions the unfunded liability component of the equation either. So anyway, I'll open it up to questions. I got to leave in about, you know, call it 10 minutes or whatever. So thanks for the invite. And if anyone else has any questions, be happy to try and address them.
Yeah, thanks. And again, I want to thank you, Foss, for coming on. I know it was last minute, but I always appreciate when you join on here. I love your insights and picking your brain on this.
It's my pleasure.
Does anybody, AC, I thought I saw your hand up. Did you have a question for Greg?
Hey, what's going on, Foss? Just a quick question, and you might have already briefly covered it, but just so it's clear, can you talk about how the Treasury auctions impact the long end of treasuries?
Certainly. Just wanted to add before that that you know, I'm a huge fan of the Bitcoin veterans and how it evolved out of maybe Cafe Bitcoin, which was you know, an initiative that was launched by Alex Stanstick from Swan, but I know he's a veteran. So shout out to you veterans for doing this. To answer the question, how do Treasury auctions impact the long end? Well, that's how the rates are. The rates are set every day because long bonds and the long end of the yield curve trades consistently all around the world, essentially 24/7, but it is largely really open for business during Wall Street hours. But bonds trade, they don't trade like stocks. They trade all around the world. The U.S. Treasury bond is traded in Japan overnight. And so that rate, and let's use 4% as a yield on the 10-year as an example. It's closer to 4.2 right now, but just using a 4% rate, how does it go from 3.6% back up to 4%, even though the short end, they cut interest rates, as I said? Well, that's by long it's by buyers and sellers of the bond price throughout the day, and there are regularly scheduled bond auctions where new debt is injected into the market, but that debt will be injected at rates that are largely set over the period between Treasury auctions. Why would you have a different rate on a U.S. 10-year bond than where it's currently trading? So you'll see things like when issued markets on the U.S. 10-year. But it's a supply and demand match where the supply is the U.S. government and the demand is from long only and, well, hedge fund buyers potentially or hedge fund sellers, but for the auction, hedge fund buyers, which are include domestic buyers, pension plans, insurance companies, banks, retail mom and pop, and then you'll have the indirect buyers, which are foreign central banks and foreign buyers, but it all adds up to a matching of the auction where you'll get the buyers and sellers, and then you'll get bid to cover ratios and the tail on the auction, how much the auction differed from the when issued market. So let's say it was trading at 4% prior to the auction and the bid to cover ratio is usually healthy, call it 2 times the buyers to the amount of debt that's being issued. But then there's a tail, and the tail could be, you know, it cleared at 4.03. So a 3 basis point tail. But all of this stuff is the statistics of the auction, but it's set by open market buyers and sellers. So I hope that answers your question. It's a regularly scheduled event where it's a matching of supply and demand of U.S. debt anywhere from 10 years to 20 years to 30-year issuance. And don't forget, as soon as the 30-year bond is issued and 6 months expire, that 30-year bond that was issued 6 months ago is now a 29.5-year bond. And the what's called the on-the-run 30-year now becomes the new 30-year that they to add a coupon, which will generally reflect the absolute level of interest rates so that the bond price is close enough to 100 cents on the dollar. But then you'll see some of those bonds that were issued at 100 cents on the dollar. If interest rates go up and bond prices go down, you'll see those bonds trading in certain cases as low as sometimes 60 cents on the dollar. Well, you're not that happy if you bought a 1% coupon bond because interest rates were 1%, but then all of a sudden now they're 4%. And the price of your bond that you paid 100 cents on the dollar for is now 60 cents on the dollar because that compensates you, or the, it compensates the new buyer at 60 cents. The Treasury's not selling any cents. It's just old bondholders perhaps are selling those bonds to buy the new 30-year or just getting out of the trade at 60 cents on the dollar. That 60 cents is what compensates the new buyer for a coupon that's meaningfully below the coupon he could get on the run 30-year bond. So interest rates don't move from 1% to 4% in 6 months, but they do move from 1% to 4% over a period of years. And that's when all these price adjustments take place. So that's what happens on a daily basis in your treasury, in the trading of treasuries. I hope that answers your question, AC.
Yeah, it does. Thanks, Foss. And I know you got to go. So just one more quick follow-up. Does that, does the lack of interest from international buyers of U.S. treasuries negatively impact or cause further further yield curve inversion because of that?
No, I don't think there's a lack of interest there could be. They could be the buyers that boycott the auctions. Are you seeing a lack of interest, or you're assuming there's a lack of interest?
I'm assuming there's a lack of interest. I'm ADIQ, so I'm not smart enough.
Well, that's good. Not that you're not, you certainly are smart enough. It's a good question, but there's an expression, right, that there's a price for everything. Maybe the auction doesn't clear at 4%, but maybe it clears at 4.25%. Then it would be a definition of a bit of a failed auction. Even though they got the debt placed in the market, the tail on the auction was a 25 basis point tail, right? It went from 4% to 4.25% in one single auction, in one single day. And that's because they had to match, you know, there's not enough. Now, there wasn't enough buy interest at 4%. They had to increase the yield, effectively decreasing the price or increasing the attractiveness of the bond to get new buyers to come in at 4.25. Would that be the definition of a failed auction? It wouldn't be a successful auction, I can guarantee you that. But, you know, there'll be a lot of indications of auctions that aren't going so well, I hope, anyway, before there's one that's a true failure where, I don't know, they actually decide that there was no buyer of the debt, of the new debt, which would indicate there's no buyers in the secondary market either. That's a pretty scary thing.
Gotcha. Thanks, Foss.
Yeah, my pleasure. Coleman, I don't have to go exactly. I don't want to hog the stage either. So there's lots of other people you can probably want to hear from. So if there's one or two more questions, I'd be happy to answer.
No, you're never hogging the stage, Greg. We enjoy, like I said earlier, we enjoy asking you questions and we enjoy your company. But I do want to welcome Lisa Huff up on the stage. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to hear Foss on this space. I was just sitting here thinking how lucky we are in Bitcoin because we have people that are experts in, you know, every facet of the world. And, you know, Foss just makes all the, to me, the really hard stuff make sense. So anyway, good morning. Happy to be with you guys. Kind of missed you for a few days.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for saying that. It's an experience that the bond market, people need to understand, is way larger than the equity market. It's way more important than the equity market in the context that, you know, it's where the financial plumbing of the entire system is reflected. And it also sets, for most arguments, what's called the risk-free rate. Now, it's not truly risk-free. And I say this because if the USA was truly a risk-free borrower, there'd be no people wanting to purchase credit default swap insurance on the USA. And right now there is people that want to purchase insurance against the default of the USA. So the fact that there's an insurance market that reflects a potential concern over the default or the credit quality of the USA indicates that it's not risk-free. But you'll read in textbooks that, you know, the USA is the risk-free, sets the risk-free rate upon which all other discount rates are set, including discount rates for stock, equity analysis, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that's why it's so important. Lisa knows that. But it is a bigger market. It's bigger. It's more important. In context, there's about $400 trillion. My number from the Institute of International Finance, global credit is about $400 trillion. And global equities is just over $125 trillion. So, you know, for a number, it's three times as large. Global credit is at least three times as large as global equities. And you'll get differing statistics, differing numbers, but just remember that it's bigger. It's traded in bigger size. It's more liquid until it isn't. When I say more liquid, there's another definition of liquidity, which is the ability to sell into a bear market. And U.S. Treasuries, there's always a bid. You may not like the bid, but there's always a bid. Whereas some stocks go no bid, some things go no bid. You'll always have a bid in U.S. Treasuries. And that, therefore, makes them very liquid, very desirable, and a benchmark for risk-free air quotes, the risk-free rate across the world.
I got a quick question for you, Greg. On Friday, I think it was released that the SEC approved option trading on Bitcoin. What kind of impact do you think this is going to have on Bitcoin's price once this gets finalized?
Well, it's a good question, and I don't actually know. I think, I think it's a good thing. You're saying they did options on IBIT, the BlackRock ETF. Options are generally a good, a valuable derivative in all markets. I don't think it'll be any different for the Bitcoin options on IBIT. And there's already options on Bitcoin that can be traded over the counter with firms like BlockFills and Galaxy Digital, for example. But options on IBIT will increase liquidity. It might also increase the risk appetite of some of the financial players, where you'll get guys that want to purchase deep out of the money. Call options, for example, you've seen this in some of the games that Wall Street plays on GameStop. But unfortunately, you've also, well, not unfortunately, it's a fact of the market. You also see these strategies being used in MicroStrategy, where they're playing, the options players are purchasing long-term equity leaps, they're called, and out-of-the-money leaps that are options that are expire in years, but you're purchasing them at prices that are so far out of the money, meaning if MicroStrategy is trading at $215 per share, you're buying these things at $315 per share. Don't quote me on that, but you know, that would be an example of a $100 out of the money option, where you get options players that are buying it. And then if you get enough options players that do that, Coleman, it causes the, you'll get what's called a options skew. I don't want to get too technical here, but you'll get, it becomes almost self-fulfilling in that the people that sold the options because you have to have a seller of the option as well, need to start buying the common stock of the issuer. So in this case, MicroStrategy, and you'll get, it becomes self-fulfilling because they've sold this option and they need to protect themselves against the potential. It's small. And what's called the delta, the amount they need to buy is small, but it's not zero. And once you get these delta hedgers in there, then you can get the infamous gamma impacts. And not getting too technical again, but gamma is basically like your acceleration, whereas your delta is your velocity, your gamma is your acceleration. And so then you add fuel to the fire when you get these gamma plays. And it could be good. It could be an instrument for raw speculation. All of which is to say that these are the games that Wall Street plays. And it will increase interest. Not the interest expense, but just will increase interest in the underlying asset, which is IBIT, the Bitcoin ETF.
All right, well, thank you for explaining that and your opinion on it. I think it'll be interesting once it they're allowed to start trading on that. But really quick, I want to give a quick thank you to our partners, Black Sheep Ammo. Restock your ammo at blacksheepammo.com, Paladin Tower Tactics, professional firearms training at paladintowertactics.com, Sola Satoshi, open source Bitcoin mining at solasatoshi.com, and Punch Plane, I saw you guys in the audience earlier, stamp your seed phrase on a metal plate at punchplate.com, and do not forget about Bitcoin Alaska being held July 5th and 6th of next year. Highly recommend getting there on the 1st, staying till about the 7th. There's going to be a lot of activities taking place before the event and after the event. If you've never been to Alaska, it's amazing. If you've never been to Alaska in the summer, it's even better. Juneau is just an amazing city, so highly recommend taking advantage of that. And we'll post more updates as we kind of get everything finalized, but start clearing your calendars now. I'd like to start moving on to a couple different topics, and something that broke earlier this morning as well was River Finance, the exchange, just released that they'll be offering 3.8% interest on all cash held on River, and that cash is going to be paid out in Bitcoin. So I see a lot of people talking about it. I personally use River. I really like them. I think they have a great product. They also have proof of reserves. You can go to their website and scroll down to their settings and just look. And you can see that all the Bitcoin they have is backed. And so I think this is going to be a game changer. And I'm not sure how they're acquiring generating the 3.8% interest. So FOSS, maybe if you have a little bit more insight as how they could offer that risk-free. I'd like to get your take, but I think it's a big change.
I'd actually prefer not to comment, Coleman, for two reasons. One, I would only be speculating as to how they're generating the yield. And then second, you know, it seems like a great product, but I haven't done enough research on it, except to say, and please, in all due respect, it wouldn't be risk-free. Okay. So don't use those words, the risk-free yield. If nothing else, there's counterparty risk for whatever's generating that yield. It seems like a great product, and congratulations to River. More ways of exploiting the reality of the time value of money and not having your cash balances sitting earning zero when you can have them earn a nominal return. Relative to the price of Bitcoin, certainly, you know, Bitcoin price could typically move that much in a single day. But anyway, it's been a pleasure speaking. I don't know if Joe Colasari just jumped up on stage if he has a rebuttal or on anything I said, but otherwise I'm going to step down.
Hey, thanks, Greg, for joining us. Again, you're welcome back anytime with or without an invitation. Again, I really appreciate when you come up here, and I know everybody listening does as well. So, again, thank you so much.
All right, my pleasure. And is Joe on stage, or is he just in the audience? I see him as a listener, but I might be wrong.
I see Joe up on stage. Good morning, Joe. How are you doing?
Yes, good morning. Hi, everyone.
So anyway, did Joe have a question or a rebuttal or anything that we typically go back and forth on, Joe? I'd be happy to try and explain my position if you had any question.
Or... Honestly, Greg, I just joined like 2 minutes ago, so I didn't hear anything.
I said anything that you would take exception with, except that I believe Druckenmiller and now Paul Tudor Jones are both short the long end of the yield curve for the same reason. And that is a concern over the balancing of the deficit budget, as well as the reality of the debt burden in the United States. But that being said, we talked about it. We did use debt to GDP numbers, not just pure debt numbers, which I know you focus on. So anyway, I'll go on mute and then step down if no one else wants to engage.
I was short the 10-year futures from on September 16th, and I closed that at 4. So I totally agree. I mean, I don't think it's a debt issue. I think it's more of an issue of supply dynamics, which are going to come to market in the early part of the year, and then also, which is slightly different. And then my only view is that I think the economy is stronger than people think. And I don't think you're going to get some significant recession in the next, you know, 2-3 quarters at least. But putting aside, Coleman, I think you were asking about the river thing. And my understanding, based on what I was reading, is that it's just basically no different than what Robinhood is doing and what all these other firms are doing. I agree with Greg, there's always counterparty risk, but all they're doing with they're not paying yield on Bitcoin. They're taking your cash and they're stuffing it into treasuries. So that's not really... I mean, it's not unusual. A lot of firms are doing that right now. A lot of online banks are doing that. They're just taking your money and stuffing it into it, you know, short-term T-bills, and that's how they're paying that yield. So I don't think that's that novel or new.
No, I think that the interesting for me was that they're paying the yield in Bitcoin, not that they're giving you yield on your Bitcoin. Is that your cash held is paid back?
Yeah, but it's dollars. It's dollars that's converted. It'd be no different if you. I mean, they're saving on transaction fees, but it right now, if you have money on, you know, not that I would ever use the platform, but if you have money on Robinhood, they pay you yield in dollars, and right, and you can just flip it over to Bitcoin. So they're just saving you on the transaction fees. I don't view that as that, you know, I mean, it's cool. Don't get me wrong. It's great that they do that. But my question is, why are you keeping significant amounts of cash when Bitcoin's at a steep discount right now? That doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but I could be wrong.
If you were just holding into your savings account or you had a business account, I could see just having not all of your, all of your net worth into Bitcoin because you need to have it a little bit more liquid. I could see holding it there, earning interest and getting that interest paid in Bitcoin. But I agree with you. If you shouldn't be holding you should be saving in Bitcoin. But if you need something a little bit more liquid, I know it's easy to hop on and off with River to utilize that.
Yeah. I mean, so there's a way you can do, I think JP Morgan Chase has, for example, a feature now that allows you to use their money market accounts, which you're, you know, still getting near 5. And when you get that yield, you can put that directly into a publicly traded ETF or equity. You know, there are folks, I had a client that was basically getting, and he had a sizable, you know, money market exposure. He's getting, you know, basically a dividend paid in IBIT, which is, you know, the BlackRock ETF. So it's very similar, but it's cool. You know, honestly, it's just a conversion tool. It just makes it easier for them to streamline. It's actually advantageous for them because it lets them streamline certain transactions, microtransactions. You know, if you've got $100,000 in cash at River right? You know, if that's paying 5% annually, roughly, you know, it's $5,000. You're dividing that among, you know, 12 months as they pay the interest. So you're really, really talking about like, you know, $400 and, you know, modest transaction volume that's going up on River's platform.
Lisa, I see you have your hand raised.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on that. I haven't read River's disclosure, but when I was at Custodia, we had a money market product where, you know, I think at the time, you know, 6 or 8 months ago, it was like 5% interest, right? So we had customers who would deposit, send cash to us. We would buy shares in a huge financial institution money market account, right? That was backed by the FDIC, so that customers did not have to hold cash at Custodia, because as you probably know, Custodia is a full reserve bank, but the FDIC refuses, or the big banking guys refuse to include Custodia into the FedMaster account system. It's not FDIC insured. So we wanted to take that I'm not sure risk is really the right word, but we wanted to take that concern off the table for our customers. It also, just looking at it from a financial institution in the Bitcoin world who's trying to onboard customers, it's a very useful tool to onboard customers, right? Because they now view you as more than just this Bitcoin company. You are actually offering banking services. You are offering, you know, in effect, a you know, access to a large money market fund. I mean, yes, as Foss said, you still have risk. You have risk to, depending on what that money market fund holds at Custodia, the one that we used, they held more than 99% of short-term duration U.S. treasuries. And then they, you know, 1% or less in cash. But to me, it's just really smart. It's a way for River to onboard new folks and make it convenient for folks to hold cash, you know, lower their risk exposure, so to speak, or their perceived, risk exposure, but also the perception of risk with holding, you know, dollars in a non-traditional banking institution.
Does anybody have anything they want to follow up with that? I like the explanation, Lisa.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, like, I don't think it's anything crazy. I think it's just, you know, like Joe said, they're just doing, you know, quote, regular banking stuff and just paying you out in Bitcoin. So I don't think it's that crazy. And I don't think it's, you know, like they were saying, you know, it's, the cash is FDIC insured, as opposed to like if something's like offering you return on your Bitcoin, that I would run away from very fast, because that means they're doing funny stuff with your Bitcoin, at least to my understanding. So I would run away from that, but, you know, getting Bitcoin return on your cash doesn't seem any riskier than other than the price risk of, like, short-term price risk of Bitcoin. But it doesn't seem any riskier than anything else.
And you have to compare, you know, if you have a significant amount of money, right, you have to compare what River's giving you versus some of these others. And I just looked into it, right? There are other FDIC insured banks that are giving you a whole 100 basis points higher than what River's paying you. So that spread is being captured by them. So you can go to other institutions, you can actually get a higher yield with, you know, money markets on your actual dollars. And then you can take that excess and spill it into Bitcoin yourself. You don't need River to do it. Now that it's cool, they're doing it in an automated fashion. It's great. But make no mistake, they're capturing a spread there versus what you would get in other accounts. You know, I'm just looking at some of these, like Green Dot and others. They're charging, you know, they're giving you 100 basis points more. So who gets that extra cash from River? That's a pretty sweet deal for them.
What's the minimum on those accounts, Joe?
$5,000.
So for me, I think it's, I don't know. I thought this was really interesting news. I just like it, seeing these Bitcoin companies starting to have similar things that traditional finance companies are offering. But I think the thing that there's no limit, there's no minimum with River. So if you're trying to onboard, again, a younger generation who doesn't have access to that amount of money, like, it gives them something. It's more than what you get at your savings account at Chase. or anything that's significant. So for me, that's what I like.
Well, it's like Fold, right? Like Fold is cool. I mean, like, it's a cool company, right? I don't have anything against them, but there are so many other credit card reward companies or that give you far better returns and rewards. And if you're doing serious volume, I mean, my Costco card's unbelievable with what I get back, you know, 4% on every gas. You could throw that into, you know, that extra money, you could throw that into Bitcoin yourself when you get those rewards checks.
Yes. And so I think we're all agreeing about the same thing. I thought it was very interesting from someone who doesn't have a lot of high net wealth to be able to go ahead and use this. It just, for me, it makes it easier to get my employees who are generally younger than 20 years old to go ahead and onboard with River.
Yeah, I think the coolest thing is just, you know, it's another avenue for onboarding people into Bitcoin. So, you know, it might be a tiny trickle, you know, for those lower income, lower savings individuals, but, you know, it's something that puts them on that path. So that I think is a positive.
Well, we are reaching the top of the hour, so I don't want to start a new topic. So I'll save it for tomorrow. But does anybody have any final comments or concerns or anything they want to brag about before we wrap up?
I was going to say something, but it's probably a new topic, so I'm not.
Go for it, sir. The floor is yours.
I just want to point out, like, there's a lot of talk yesterday about, like, the ECB's or somebody at the ECB, like, put out that paper that was largely viewed as, like, an attack on Bitcoin. And it happens to coincide with, like the BRICS meetings, which are being hosted in Russia. And, you know, I've said it a couple times on here that I don't see, you know, the BRICS, any of the BRICS currencies formulating something to oppose the dollar. But I could see them maybe using something like Bitcoin as an alternative. And just the timing of that seems
100%.
Yeah. Just the timing of it, you know, like as Russia is hosting all these countries and there's all this talk about them trying to find an alternative to the US dollar system. And, you know, Bitcoin's just right there. And it really does, in my mind, give them proportional like say or value in or power in that system proportionate to their, you know, natural resources. So, like, you know, Russia will be able to mine more and they'll have, you know, quote, like greater control because they'll be able to mine more Bitcoin and stuff than a smaller country that doesn't have the same kind of natural gas and energy reserves and stuff like that. So like in my mind, when I see them going on the attack like that, with the timing of, you know, BRICS openly saying they're looking for an alternative, I really think that there might be some concern on the Bitcoin front there. And I posted a screenshot from one of my articles. I've posted it before, but it just shows like the BRICS currency is losing value faster than the dollar versus in terms of like gold purchasing power. Versus versus like Bitcoin, which, you know, goes up in terms of purchasing power. And again, that wouldn't require, you know, state A sacrificing sovereignty to state B. You know, they would be removing themselves from the dollar system, which would, you know, take away that power from the United States, and they'd be putting it into a system, you know, that's, you know, decentralized, and you know, they'd be taking the power from us and, you know, giving the power to nobody, basically, which to an adversary I think is a big win. So just wanted to
think it's also there. It's also important to piggyback on that on the 1st of November Russia is banning or is allowing non-government agencies to start mining Bitcoin again. So I think you're onto something there, Yomar. But I do think we're just becoming the world's becoming more divided, and there's going to be different. It's not going to be so centralized, and so it's going to take a time. I don't think it's going to be really quick where they figure out that Bitcoin's the answer, or whatever currency they choose in the interim. But I do think we're starting to see shifts going on. And I had a lot of articles to kind of back up my thesis or thoughts on this, but we'll go ahead and discuss this tomorrow because I'd like to cover it in some length. So on that, unless anybody has any rebuttals to what we just said. Nope. Okay. So we'll go ahead and wrap up the show here. I want to thank everybody who tuned in, all of the speakers today, Foss, Texas Toast, Bitcoin Petro, AC, Lisa, Eomar, Jacob for doing everything in the background. I really appreciate it. It means a lot to me, everybody in the audience. Again, there's over 300 of you listening today. I can't name you all, but I see you out there. I see you coming on every day. So please keep tuning in. We do this Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. Eastern time. And I really do appreciate your support. We are going to postpone the Bitcoin Veterans video podcast again tonight. We just still have our main core group of guys are still in North Carolina helping out. And so we just don't have, we don't have the personnel to go ahead and do the video tonight. But I believe we will be releasing a video in the next couple of days about it, what we're doing with Operation Gabriel in North Carolina and giving you a thorough update with that. So stay tuned for more updates with that. Again, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I want you guys to go out there and just crush it. Talk about Bitcoin, show them what we can do with this freedom tech technology, but do not shitcoin. It's like buying a lottery ticket with yesterday's numbers.